It's Thursday, July 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Greece defaults on an International Monetary Fund loan as European Union ministers hold more talks.
It seems that we might be at somewhat of a standoff here for several more days with no new negotiations.
The head of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff says the international security situation is unstable. And as the 4th of July holiday approaches, we hear some country songs that celebrate America. It's all ahead. As we heard in the news, Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis says he will resign his post if Greek voters approve Sunday's referendum on bailout terms demanded by the country's European creditors. Varoufakis said in a televised interview today that if Greece accepts the EU creditors' bailout proposal on Sunday, he'll not be finance minister the following day. Varoufakis said he expects Greeks to reject the bailout proposal, which would require tax increases and spending cuts in exchange for further aid. He said he would rather cut off his own arm, that's a figure of speech, than sign a new deal that does not restructure Greece's debt. On Wednesday, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras said he's sticking with plans for Sunday's referendum, but expressed willingness to accept terms much like those his government has previously rejected. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with VOA's Ken Brademeyer about the financial crisis in Greece.
The Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras offered some concessions to the creditors, but it wasn't enough to get anybody to come back to the negotiating table. And then later in the day, he made a national television speech in which he urged his fellow Greeks to vote no on Sunday in the referendum on whether the country ought to accept more austerity in exchange for more bailout loans. As a result, it seems that we might be at somewhat of a standoff here for several more days with no new negotiations. The finance ministers met later Wednesday evening, and they decided it was no time to hold more talks. Let's wait and see what happens in the referendum, is essentially what they said.
Of course, Greece is trying to put forth some new plans, but they seem to be getting a lukewarm reception.
Very lukewarm. I would say it's that would be charitable to say that. It's more hostile than anything. Much of Europe seems to be fed up with this continuing drama with no end in sight, although the referendum is certainly going to be a key factor. I should note that European leaders say and have told Greece that a no vote is tantamount to leaving the Eurozone, the 19-country euro currency bloc, whereas the prime minister looks at the no vote, at least that's what he told his people Wednesday night, he called it a decisive step for a better agreement. And he says that Greece would aim to sign, straight after the referendum, a new deal. Now, whether that's possible or not, or whether there even will be a no vote, is unknown at this point. A yes vote, which is to say a vote against Tsipras's wishes, would probably result in a new government in Athens. It would be hard to imagine that the Syriza party would be able to hang on to power if the people of Greece don't want to accept his stance anymore. Mm-hmm. So there's much at stake on Sunday for sure.
Be very interesting to see how the people decide on this one, because the choices are quite large. If you're looking at leaving the Eurozone and going for a new government, wow, that's an interesting choice, I guess, depending how you are doing at the moment.
That's certainly a major decision for the voters. Probably most Greeks would say they want to be part of Europe. They consider themselves part of Europe, and part of Europe, at least for most countries outside of England and Switzerland, a couple other countries. There are 19 countries in the Eurozone. So Greek has an identity there, which would be dumped with unknown results, were the Greeks to depart from the Eurozone.
That's VOA's Ken Brademeyer talking with Jim Stevenson. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, the breaking news this morning is out of the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard. It's actually just a few short blocks away from where we are here in VOA. And this was the site of a mass shooting back in September 2013 where 12 people were killed. And we're getting reports now this morning, breaking reports, that there's been another mass shooting there, some kind of shooting incident. So Navy Yard has quickly jumped up on Twitter. It's now the top trending topic on Twitter, which speaks to the immediacy of social media. You have people sharing photos from the scene, photos from their apartment buildings that are nearby. So more to follow on that story for sure. Now, shifting gears now, we have a battle brewing online over guacamole.
Of all things.
The New York Times kicked it off yesterday. They sent out a tweet that said, add green peas to your guacamole. Trust us. And this set off a firestorm because green peas are not necessarily something you'd add to guacamole. Maybe
no.
Onions or peppers.
Yeah.
So it set off this firestorm on social media. Hashtag peas please and hashtag peas pass are the two different hashtags that are trending. Actually, hashtag peas pass was the one that was trending in the U.S., I guess because people don't want peas in their guacamole. Among the people who said that it's ridiculous are President Obama. He's weighed in. He said, respect the New York Times, but not buying peas in guac. Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush also says, you don't put peas in guacamole, tweeting that out yesterday. So a battle brewing of all things over guacamole. And speaking of President Obama, there's actually another change to social media at the White House. Starting today, when you go on a White House tour, you can now take pictures at the White House. You weren't able to do that previously. Michelle Obama actually announcing on her Instagram account saying, before today, you might have seen this sign. She holds up a sign that says, no photos in social media allowed. And she tears the sign in half and says, well, not anymore. So the White House is encouraging people not just to take pictures, but to share them on social media using the hashtag White House Tour. People, especially young people, already praising it, saying they're looking forward to going on the tour and sharing all their photos with their friends.
Yeah, interesting. Well, thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Environmentalists in South Korea are protesting a Winter Olympics construction project to build a ski slope through a 500-year-old protected forest. Brian Padden reports that although there's strong national support for hosting the 2018 Winter Olympics, there are growing public concerns over the costs and possible ecological damage at the revered mountain.
The ground is already being cleared on Gariwang Mountain for the 2018 Olympic ski race course. Organizers say they saved some of the oldest trees before clear-cutting the rest. But activists with Green Korea United want development to stop before it inflicts permanent damage on this fragile ecosystem.
If they give up and for moving to another site, some established ski resort, then it could be recovered, though it would take some years or decades. So,
at the mountain base, an ancient stone sign dates to the 500-year reign of the Joseon Dynasty, which ended in 1897. Activist Lee Byung-chun, who is retired from the Korea National Arboretum, says this was a royal forbidden preserve where wild ginseng once grew for the exclusive use of the king.
The government designated this area as a protected region at that time. And that history has continued for about 500 years since then.
The mountain is considered a sacred place for Koreans, he says. Many plant species native to these mountains have been preserved here for half a millennia.
This is Kingon fir, a type of conifer. These firs can grow here due to cool climate in this area.
The Olympic organizers contend that Gariwang is the only nearby mountain tall and steep enough to host downhill ski events. In 2012, the South Korean government lifted the mountain's protected status to allow it to be used in the Olympics. Authorities insist they will restore the forest afterwards. Still, environmentalists contend that damage being done by the Olympic construction will likely leave a permanent scar. Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute. NASA has built a prototype of what it hopes to be the first aircraft to fly over the surface of Mars sometime in the 2020s. Shaped like a boomerang, the flying wing Prandtl M will be rather small, with a 61-centimeter wingspan and weighing only about 454 grams. The designers are planning to send this drone-like aircraft to Mars in a CubeSat, a miniaturized satellite. Once deployed in the Martian atmosphere, the aircraft then can glide down and land. NASA plans to use the Prandtl M to fly around Mars to look for possible landing sites for future manned missions to the Red Planet. The aircraft will also send back high-resolution images that could tell scientists about the suitability of those landing sites. NASA is planning to test launch the Prandtl M from a high-altitude balloon later this year. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, country songs celebrate America. Today's global security environment is the most unpredictable I've seen in 40 years of service. That's how U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Martin Dempsey begins his quadrennial National Military Strategy Assessment, released on Wednesday. General Dempsey warns that global disorder has significantly increased, while some of America's comparative military advantage has begun to erode. The outgoing chairman says the U.S. now faces multiple simultaneous security challenges from traditional state actors, notably Russia and China, and trans-regional networks of sub-state groups, or what he calls VEOs, violent extremist organizations, all taking advantage of rapid technological change. The Army General cites ballistic missiles, precision strike technologies, unmanned systems, space and cyber capabilities, and weapons of mass destruction as technologies designed to counter U.S. military advantages and deny access to regions of the world. Ralph Kosa, head of the Hawaii-based Pacific Forum Security Think Tank, has read the report, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty that, for now at least, he prefers to emphasize the low risk of conflict with another major power.
I don't think anybody, and certainly the document isn't predicting a war, but, you know, it's saying that the military has to be prepared to execute the national security strategy, which is protecting U.S. interests, and you have to identify the challenges to those interests. And certainly the one competitor that's come back on the scene since the last national security strategy has been Russia. And it's been, you know, it's come back with a vengeance. Some would say it never left. We just took our eye off the ball. But, you know, the point is that the Russians are now trying to revive, I guess, their old glory or something. And the events in Crimea and elsewhere in Ukraine force you to, you know, to take them seriously. China remains the long-term challenge. I think most people will tell you the gap in capabilities between the U.S. and China, while perhaps smaller than it was previously, is still considerable. And, of course, the U.S. also has a technological edge, but it also has an edge as far as allies and everything are concerned. I didn't find it particularly alarmist, just that we need to be prepared. We have two kinds of threats. One is the traditional threats from state actors, and the other is the non-traditional threats from non-state actors. And now we have a new one that we didn't even know about 5 years ago, and that's ISIL or ISIS. And that creates a new challenge. The type of military that you build to be prepared to respond to a direct challenge from Russia or China is different from the type of military you need to respond to an ISIS threat.
General Dempsey leads off in his foreword by saying today's global security environment is the most unpredictable I've seen in 40 years of service. What's he referring to?
ISIS is part of that. North Korea is part of that. You know, in the good old days, the threat was very predictable. It was the Soviet Union and, you know, the Warsaw Pact. While the consequences of war were obviously, you know, the end of mankind as we knew it, if it got out of hand, it was manageable in that there were two main players and they both understood each other, and we spent a lot of time talking to one another to make sure there wouldn't be inadvertent conflict and, you know, rules of engagement and understandings and strategic talks. Now you've got some folks out there like ISIS who you're not quite sure how to deal with them or what they're aiming at. And then you have countries like North Korea who are scary because here's a nation with a young dictator who's got nuclear weapons. And while you may have had some confidence that his father knew what he was doing or his grandfather, you're less confident about his intentions or understanding of geopolitical reality.
Since the last report issued in 2011, 4 years ago, General Dempsey said global disorder has trended upward while some of our comparative advantages have begun to erode. What does he mean?
We've seen the Russians now starting to modernize their nuclear force. We've seen the Chinese getting much better in terms of the types of weapon systems that they have. They're developing anti-access area denial weapons. So I think that's changed the calculus. But in my own assessment anyway, the gap is still considerable between our technological capabilities and those of others, even if that gap has narrowed somewhat.
That's Ralph Kossa of the Pacific Forum. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Saturday is Independence Day here in the United States. Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong stopped by to chat with David Byrd about some of the tunes that celebrate America.
This week, the United States celebrates its 239th birthday. Country music is celebrating that with several patriotic hits, but Nikki Strong joins us in the studio. I want to chat about some stuff that people might not have thought of. Now, some of these are pretty obvious, okay? Sure. Some of them, like Only in America by Brooks and Dunn.
Yes, yes.
Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning by Alan
favorite.
Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
That's your favorite.
Yes.
Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue by Toby Keith.
That's also a favorite for a lot of folks.
Also American Soldier by
yes.
Toby Keith.
Yes.
But, you know, in thinking about this, there's some songs that maybe people didn't think of.
Mm-hmm.
Jason Aldean, Fly Over States.
Really?
It talks about all these states that people fly over and they, you know, and he talks about trains hauling steel and, you know, corn being grown
yes.
and all that kind of stuff.
What's great about a lot of country music songs is that they do paint pictures of American life.
That's true. And even Kenny Chesney's hit, American Kids,
mm-hmm.
growing
mm-hmm.
up in little pink houses, making
yes.
out in living room couches. I mean, that's
yes.
me in high school,
yeah.
all right? I don't
that's
know about,
a lot of people.
I don't know about the rest of you all, but, you know, my girlfriend's daddy had a shotgun above the door.
Yikes.
So, okay.
We were Jesus, Sammy, blue jean baby, born in the USA. Trailer park, truck stop, faded little map dots, New York to L.A. We were teenage dreaming, front seat leaning, baby, come give me a kiss. Put me on the cover of the Rolling Stone, uptown, down home, American kids.
There's another one that I thought of, too, The Only Way I Know.
Mm-hmm.
Luke Bryan. That's the only way I, you know, Luke Bryan and Jason Aldean and Eric Church.
Mm-hmm.
talks about growing up in a small town.
Sure.
So what else we got on the list there?
Oh, my goodness. Well, there are tons. A couple of ones that I find to be interesting because they're kind of a little bit off the beaten path. One of them is The Ballad of Ira Hayes, which was a folk song. It's been recorded by a lot of different artists, including Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger. But this version was the most popular, and it was by Johnny Cash. And it tells the story of a Pima Indian that served in the Marine Corps in World War II and was one of the men that raised the flag over Iwo Jima.
Oh, okay.
So, and you see the iconic photograph, yes, and only to return home to his reservation and lose his life to alcoholism.
Brantley Gilbert, one hell of an amen.
Yes.
That's a great song.
Yes, it tells a story.
You know,
yes.
Those are all, you know, they're not really jingoistic, like, you know,
no.
Yay, America, wave the flag.
No.
But they tell an American story.
Yeah, they do. They do. And I think that's part of when you think of country music and celebrating American life in all of its aspects and telling stories. And so my favorite country song of all time, well, not of all time, as far as celebrating July the 4th, is Alan Jackson, Where Were You? When the world stopped turning. He really captures the myriad, the variety of emotions that people experience in relation to 9/11. And even if you weren't directly impacted by 9/11, if you've ever been impacted by war, this song really moves you.
All right, that's VOA's Nikki Strong. We welcome your comments. You can check us out at VOA_IE on Twitter. Nikki is also on VOA_music
yes.
on Twitter.
Yes.
And you can also catch her on Country Hits USA by logging on to our website. That's www.voanews.com.
Where were you when the world stopped turning on that September day?
And that's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While there's been much encouraging news about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa in recent months, new infections of the virus continue, and the United States remains committed to doing what it takes to stop them. U.S. Ebola treatment units and basic response infrastructure are in place, and thousands of U.S.-supported civilian responders are at work to fight the disease. It's killed more than 11,000 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and a handful of other countries, including our own. Liberia has been declared Ebola-free, but is still within a 90-day period on heightened security for recurrence of the disease. New cases continue to emerge elsewhere, with 8 recently identified in Sierra Leone and 12 in Guinea. Cases continue in areas bordering Guinea-Bissau, and efforts to ensure that country is better prepared for Ebola cases are underway. The U.S. National Institutes of Health is conducting trials on various candidate Ebola vaccines, including a controlled trial on the effectiveness of one vaccine in particular. NIH is also testing therapeutic drug candidates to treat those who have been infected, working to improve diagnosis of the disease, which has so far required sophisticated, labor-intensive DNA analysis, and trying to better understand how it causes the disease. In other words, the United States is supporting a wide range of research on prevention and treatment of Ebola. Meanwhile, a partnership between U.S. and Liberian researchers is studying approximately 7,500 people in that country, including 1,500 who survived Ebola within the last 2 years. Health investigators want to better understand Ebola's long-term health consequences and determine if survivors develop long-term immunity that will protect them from future infection. They also would like to better understand how the Ebola virus can persist in some organs of survivors long after they appear to have recovered, and the degree of risk that they can transmit the virus to others. While we have succeeded in controlling the exponential growth of the disease, getting to zero cases will require a sustained international response. The fight is far from over, and we remain committed to achieving an Ebola-free West Africa. The research U.S. and other scientists are carrying out now will improve the odds of preventing any future outbreak of Ebola from spreading, as the 2014 epidemic did.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.